Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
If things are going well in your country, who cares about democracy? That question was in effect on the ballot in two major nations over the weekend. Voters in Venezuela and Russia went to the polls in what was seen as a test of their respective democracies. And most headlines and comments so far see the results as a win for democracy in Venezuela, where President Hugo Chavez's proposed changes to the Constitution were narrowly defeated, and not much of a win in Russia, where President Vladimir Putin's party won parliamentary elections overwhelmingly amid calls of foul from the opposition and suspicions about what Putin might do to retain power, officially or unofficially, when his term runs out next year. Does democracy matter? Does democracy matter everywhere? Can voters be convinced to back away from the democratic process voluntarily? Does the democratic process always make things more fair or just anyway? We have two guests with us, one to talk more about Russia, one to talk more about Venezuela, but first certainly to talk about the principles involved. Stephen Cohen is a professor of history and Russian and Slavic languages at NYU. John Walsh is a senior associate for the Andes at the Washington office on Latin America, a think tank that focuses on this hemisphere. Thank you both for joining me this morning. Hello.
Thank you. Hello.
Let's start by just telling the story briefly, because most people don't follow closely politics in any other country. John Walsh, what was the referendum vote all about in Venezuela and what happened?
Well, it was a huge raft of reforms to Venezuela's constitution, which was only put into effect in 1999. Chavez has won handily elections over the past 8 years, so it was a surprise that this was defeated. And it was defeated, as you said, by a very narrow margin.
And President Chavez, for all his critics' charges of despotism, has said he will abide by the vote. Do you believe him?
I do believe him. I mean, he said it and he's done it. The question is, will he now try to use other means to implement some of the changes that he tried to do via the constitutional reform?
And what was this constitutional set of reforms? Why would it have been anti-democratic in so many people's point of view?
I think one of the major reasons was that it would have allowed Chavez to run for re-election as many times as he wanted. And some people say, well, that not to have term limits is not necessarily anti-democratic. In fact, it's more democratic. But I think a lot of Venezuelans felt that that would have amassed too much power.
But it went beyond that. He wanted to be able to legitimately declare states of emergencies more easily. He wanted people, in effect, to sign off on his closing down an opposition television station recently, as well as changes to the economy, but I think those were in a different category.
Right. Well, there were 69 discrete proposals.
Whoa.
And many of them had nothing to do with the other. So those that you mentioned, in particular, the ability to call a state of emergency and the few checks on that power that are in the Constitution now, including the National Assembly and the courts, would have been removed. So that was troubling to people as well.
And I'll just note for the record, and we'll talk about it more tomorrow, that the Supreme Court in this country is going to hear the Guantanamo case in which President Bush wants to say that the courts have no jurisdiction to question the president's rulings in some of these matters. But that's a third country. Stephen Cohen, in the Russian election, there was no explicit question on the ballot about Putin's power. It was a parliamentary election. But was that a subtext?
Well, it was fairly explicit in the advertising. Putin's party, such as it is, and the Kremlin said, though this is was a parliamentary election on Sunday, this is a vote for or against Putin 7-8 years in power. So in that sense, it was much like Chavez's. It was a plebiscite or a referendum on his authority and his future, his past. As I say, formally, it was a parliamentary election. Russia, I guess, unlike Venezuela, which I don't know very well, is in a process of de-democratization. And that reflected itself in this respect. Had this been a fair play election, Putin's party would have won, probably 40 to 45%. But the Kremlin wanted something more. It wanted in excess of 60% so that it would have a constitutional majority. That's about 300-plus votes in a 450-person Duma, so that it would have the option. It doesn't mean they're going to do it, but the option to change the Constitution regarding how and how long Putin could stay in power. When I say it's an option, the interesting thing is though we look to Russia and to the Kremlin as a kind of wily political center, they don't know exactly what to do with or about Putin. But they've now created some options they didn't have before yesterday, the option to change the Constitution.
Are you saying this election was rigged?
Well, you know, it depends on what you mean by rigged. We have a long history in that part of the world of 99.9% of votes. Some of them we accept, as when our protege in Georgia, former Soviet Georgia, Saakashvili, got 96% of the vote about 2 years ago. We said it was democracy. Putin's party yesterday got about 64%, and we say it was rigged. Here's how it's rigged. In Russia, as in the United States and in most literate societies, alas, I guess, over 80% of the people get all their national news from television. The Kremlin controls the three or four national networks, that is, the television stations that reach the entire nation. And for the last 2 months, they've praised Putin and kept the opposition off the air. That's a form of rigging. I mean, people can, of course, make up their own minds, but when you are battered by a flow of information built upon Putin's authentic popularity, that's a pretty overwhelming advantage. The second thing they did is in the actual campaigning, they made it very difficult for opposition parties. They kept them off the air. They wouldn't give them permits to meet. They confiscated their election material. The usual ticky-tack sort of unfair tactics. But the most interesting thing they probably did, and this may not be noted in the Western press, but it's very interesting, is that the two polling services, survey services in Russia that are independent of the Kremlin, said that the Communist Party would get about 18%, and that it would be the only other party to enter the Duma. In fact, it got just over 11%. If the polls were correct, what happened to the missing 6 or 7%? And my guess is, it's more than a guess, it's an educated guess, that the Kremlin gave it to these two other pro-Kremlin parties to get them across the 7% threshold into the new parliament so that the Communist Party wouldn't be the only other party in the parliament. And the reasons why it did that are a separate story, but I think that probably, if there was falsification of the vote, that was where it was, in shifting that 6 or 7% from the Communists to the two other Kremlin parties.
And Garry Kasparov, the chess champion, is quoted as saying, and he's a big critic of Putin, that the vote was, quote, the most unfair and dirtiest in the whole history of modern Russia. Listeners, we're going to open up our phones on both of these countries, Venezuela and Russia, and the votes over the weekend, and the larger questions involved, the implications for the United States, the meaning of democracy in the world. And we're going to give first priority to people who are from Russia, from Venezuela, 212-433-WNYC. What do the rest of us not understand about notions of democracy in your countries of origin, or the balance between democracy and other desires, other priorities in your countries? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And everyone else, how much attention should we pay to democracy elsewhere and why? Call us at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Russian expats, Venezuelan expats, we particularly want to hear from you. 212-433-9692 for Stephen Cohen, professor of history and Russian and Slavic languages at NYU, and John Walsh, senior associate for the Andes at the Washington Office on Latin America. 212-433-WNYC. And John, the vote in Venezuela was really close. It was 51% to 49% against these changes that Chavez wanted to make. And so, as close as it was, does it raise the question of how close a call it is for people between whether they'd rather have some abstract notion of democracy or the prosperity that they may associate with Chavez, especially the populist prosperity that they, if they're poor, they may associate with Chavez and the way he's been spreading the oil wealth around?
Well, actually, I think that's an interesting question, and the answer is I think Chavez miscalculated on this bid because he lost about 1.6 million votes that he had when he won re-election just last December. And if you look to why, although Chavez tried to make this vote a plebiscite on him, that's not how people took it. People, his supporters especially, realized that they can disagree on this. They can still be Chavistas. They can still enjoy having Hugo Chavez as their president and still even revere him. And their gains over these years and having him as their champion in office isn't sacrificed. So I think it was sort of a tactic that backfired in this case. People weren't persuaded that they needed to approve these reforms to remain a Chavista.
Stephen Cohen, do the two countries have something in common here, which is that they've both been doing very well economically because of rising oil prices the last few years, and that makes it easier for the heads of state to say, forget all that democracy stuff, I'm your champion, things are going great, or at least better, and we can extend that by extending me?
Yeah, what they have in common is oil, and that's a very good thing to have these days with oil about $90 to $100 a barrel, almost unprecedented. Secondly, they have a rising tide of anti-Americanism, which is indigenous in both in Russia and in Latin America, and that's very important. And thirdly, they have something that we disdain. I don't personally, because I grew up in Kentucky and was part of the politics, namely political populism. Leaderships that pledge to lift people out of poverty, to smite the oligarchs, and to use the new riches of the nation to rebuild or expand the basic social service infrastructure of the country. Now, whether or not these governments actually do that, I don't know about Venezuela. In Russia, it has and it hasn't. But those are the things it has in common at the moment. Obviously, there's more democracy in Venezuela, and good for Venezuela. In Russia, there's a kind of tragedy of the de-democratization of the country since 1989. But in terms of what they have in common, democracy aside, those three things I mentioned.
Let's take a phone call from Nadia in the Bronx of Venezuelan origin, who I think wants to question the meaning of democracy that we're assuming in this conversation. Nadi, thanks for calling. You're on WNYC.
Hi, good morning.
So what are you thinking?
Oh, that I'm really disappointed at the media because Chavez is a great leader and he's helping the poor. And I'm really disappointed at the meaning of democracy that the Western Hemisphere gives, meaning that you have to be poor and happy and let the elitist white class dominate like they have been doing in Venezuela for years, and they don't mention the 4,000 poor people that they killed in the 80s because they were mobilizing against the president, Perez, and Chavez is helping the very poorest of the poor, like the indigenous people, the blacks, all the people that want to work, all the people is sick and tired of handouts.
And if he can bring about that greater equality that you're holding as perhaps the highest value, then you don't care if he can suspend the Constitution, weaken the independent judiciary, shut down opposition media, things like that?
Yeah, but all this legal terminology that you're using, judiciary, whatever, is people stealing nicely. Look, like, they have been stealing money in Venezuela, all these fake powers, over the years, with beautiful letters. Look at the coup that they gave him. And these white, beautiful people, they wanted to take over the country. Chavez is distributing the riches of the oil.
John Walsh, you want to engage Nadi?
Oh, yeah, I think he's right. I mean, why does Chavez resonate and have such strong backing, or to date, why has he achieved such success at the polls? Precisely because the old elites were so discredited as corrupt, and then they proved, many of them, their anti-democratic credentials by launching a coup against an elected president, that people were fed up and looking for someone who was going to be their champion. And Chavez not only rode that wave, but shaped it too. And he's in the position he is now, which is, despite this defeat, which was a stinging one, he has five more years in his term. His party controls the National Assembly, so he still has enormous room for maneuver, and he is not only but the formidable political force in Venezuela. It's up to the opposition at this point to promote a positive platform, not just defeat things, a positive platform that will include the poor. Otherwise, there's little prospect that the Chavismo that Chavez has set in motion is going to be detained by the old formulas of the elite. That doesn't work anymore.
We'll continue in a minute with Stephen Cohen and John Walsh. More of your phone calls. Thanks to the Russians and Venezuelans calling in. We'll get to you. And we'll also ask the question, since anti-Americanism is a factor in both countries, what are the implications of these votes for the United States? For you and me, stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and have you been polled? We are teaming with the Huffington Post to learn more about how pollsters operate and how they reach their conclusions that often fuel the very races they're supposed to be analyzing. If you have ever been polled and are willing to fill out a 5-minute questionnaire to help shed some light on democracy in this country, go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show for the polling project. Also, don't forget, WNYC continues to bring you the major presidential campaign debates tomorrow afternoon at 2. It's NPR's own Democratic candidates debate, 2 p.m. tomorrow on AM 820 WNYC. We're talking about the elections in Venezuela and Russia over the weekend, where democracy itself was at stake, with Stephen Cohen, history and Russian Slavic and languages professor at NYU, and John Walsh, senior associate for the Andes at the think tank called the Washington Office on Latin America, and Macaulay in Shokan, upstate. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian, and your guests. I'm a chess journalist and have covered tournaments internationally, so I followed Kasparov for many years.
Uh-huh.
And one thing that he frequently points to is the control of the media in Russia, which I think can't be underestimated. When I talk to my friends in Moscow, they routinely are not aware of the kinds of stories that are coming out in the foreign press about problems in the country. And so, you know, it's very difficult to have an election, to have democracy, when you don't have that free access to information. And one other point that they often point to, my friends, that is that there were so many problems in the 90s when Putin was coming to power. The country was in so much disarray that the need for some stability and security really trumped a lot of democratic concerns. And even now, people are, you know, it's in relatively recent memory, and so they're willing to sacrifice some of their liberties for the sake of security. And I think these are both, you know, quite significant in terms of the history of democracy and preservation of democracy in general.
Kasparov needs some better moves right about now. But Stephen Cohen, want to talk to Macaulay?
No, I think what he said is correct. I think the most important point that he made is that in the 1990s, the majority of Russians went through great social economic hardship, pain. Men, even today, typically lived only 58 years old in Russia, down from about 65 under the Soviet system.
Uh-huh.
People lost their jobs, their pensions, their salaries were evaporated by inflation, and they're doing better today, and they attribute that to Putin. I don't think they regard that kind of vote as against democracy. The problem with democracy in Russia is what we, the United States, and the Yeltsin government called democracy in Russia in the 1990s was something very nasty. One of the misfortunes of American foreign policy is to call things democracy and democratic that really aren't in the eyes of the people of those countries. We continue to do that. Russia's the prime case in the last 20 years, but I think your caller's right about that.
Kevin in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, thanks. My comment is about sort of the loss of American credibility in judging elections in the former Soviet Union. I worked there in the late 90s with an American organization.
Uh-huh.
And there was this this desire kind of to please the Americans in how well they were doing democracy. But after the 2000 elections and you know, just American unilateralism, the American credibility is just so low now that the moral influence of, you know, looking good toward the Americans just isn't there anymore.
Stephen?
Absolutely right. And the primary reason, some people think it's Florida and what happened between Bush and Gore, but the primary reason is the American war in Iraq. The woman who is the most venerable and respected leader of the civil human rights movement in Russia told Condi Rice, the Secretary of State, when she came to Russia to preach democracy promotion, a misguided aspect of our foreign policy, to the human rights advocates is that this woman told Condi Rice, you no longer have any credibility after the war in Iraq to speak to us about democracy.
And the U.S. is discredited in Venezuela because it backed a coup against Chavez even after the Latin American countries had decided among themselves not to back any more military coups from left or right.
Right. No, that's exactly the case. I think the U.S., the Bush administration in particular, has almost zero credibility in Venezuela when it comes out talking about democracy and human rights issues. And I think one of the larger, you know, of all the countless costs of the Bush war in Iraq launching a unilateral invasion is the cost to U.S. credibility in talking about these issues. I don't say that from the perspective of someone who thinks the U.S. has always been right. I mean, most of the time our actions have been far short of our rhetoric. But that's different from saying sometimes we could be right and sometimes we could use power in the right way. The U.S. really doesn't have, the Bush administration really doesn't have that credibility right now.
So what's at stake for the United States in the Venezuelan vote, do you think?
Well, I think overall for the United States and for this particular administration and any of the major political actors is the stable flow of oil continuing from Venezuela. And ironically, the only time that it's been interrupted over these years of Chavez's presidency was when the opposition promoted a strike, which shut down the flow of oil to the U.S. for a couple of months. Otherwise, Chavez has let it flow, and his threats to stop it are pretty hollow because he needs the U.S. market just as much as the U.S. market needs his oil.
And I don't know if you saw Roger Cohen's column in the New York Times today, but his point, it's kind of a world is flat column, even though he wasn't Thomas Friedman, which is that trade seems to trump politics in the case of many countries and the United States right now, because Venezuela, for all its anti-American sentiment, for all Chavez talks about cutting down trade with the United States, there's just so much business that, excuse me, there's a lot more business between the two countries than there was when Chavez took office.
Right. Well, the Venezuelan economy is booming, and the U.S. has a lot to do with that, in particular as the major market for Venezuelan oil. Make no mistake, Chavez is looking to diversify markets for Venezuelan oil, but that doesn't happen overnight.
Is there a similar dynamic with Russia, Stephen?
Yeah, there are alternative markets, China in particular. China desperately needs oil and gas, and that's an optional market for Russia. Of course, you have to find a way to ship it there. You can't reverse pipelines, and you have to build new pipelines or use more ships. But I assume Chavez, too. I think he's selling more oil to the Chinese. I'm not sure about that. But the world's thirsty for oil. Oil's running out, and not many countries have it. So I think it would be folly for the United States to assume, well, we buy a lot of oil from them. Therefore, there are limits to how much power they have over us.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We're talking about the historic votes over the weekend in Venezuela and Russia, where, in a way, democracy itself was on the ballot, with John Walsh from the Washington Office on Latin America and Stephen Cohen, Russia expert at NYU, and Ed in Patterson. You're on WNYC. Hi, Ed.
Yes, hi. I agree with a lot of what's been said, and would add that not only has the Bush administration squandered a lot of the legitimacy of the United States, or the little legitimacy it might have had in both regions, but they've actually helped give credibility to the likes of Chavez and Putin because of moves like trying to assassinate very publicized attempts, bungled attempts to assassinate Chavez. And also, using terrorism as a tactic to de-democratize America. That's, you know, Putin is using that right out of our playbook. In addition, I would ask this question. Is it what's better, to have a media that's in bed with government or a media that's controlled by government? I mean, here our media self-centers and cheerleads us into these wars, apology notwithstanding, from the New York Times. You know, is it better to pretend to be a great democracy and have all this gamesmanship going on in the background, or not even pretend to be like a great democracy like Russia or Venezuela and then fall short of it? Which is worse?
Stephen Cullen, do you think that for all the faults, obviously, in the American system, that Ed paints with too broad a brush to just make us the equivalent of those countries?
Oh, we're not the equivalent, but we are at an extremely dangerous moment that Ed points to. I think he points to it. What's going to happen as a result of this election in Russia is that the professional democracy promoters in the United States are now campaigning.
Whoops, are we losing Stephen Cullen? Well, John Walsh, why don't you take that question for the moment?
I think part of I disagree with part of the premise, which is that Venezuela is, you know, going through the same sort of de-democratization that Russia is, not knowing the Russian case as well. But I think that's not the case in Venezuela. I think yesterday's vote is a vindication for and another example of strong participation by Venezuelans in the electoral process. They decided to vote against this by a slim margin, but nevertheless a real margin.
Right, although let me point out, as you well know, that there was only 56% turnout there, a percentage so low that it's reminiscent of the United States. And also, it was apparently Chavez's backers, by and large, who didn't come out. The opposition was very mobilized. And so, presumably, with a 51 to 49 percentage vote that was so close among those who did vote, potentially voters could, a year from now, decide to voluntarily, and I guess that's an act of democracy, walk away from some of the constitutional protections that they have.
Yep, that is certainly possible. I think you put your finger on it, too, is that the difference this time was that a lot of Chavistas, or people who don't count themselves as supporters of the president but who have voted for him in the past, either stayed home or voted no this time around. But my main point is that there has been a lot of backfiring tactics on the part of the opposition in Venezuela over the years to their own detriment, basically by saying don't participate because you'll legitimate the illegitimate. This time, no holds barred. They tried to get their people out to vote. Now, the participation level, by Venezuelan perspective, was rather low. On the other hand, I think each side has learned that to the extent you discredit the electoral process and try to make a lot of the low turnout, you're going to ultimately harm yourself as well.
Yevgeny in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Oh, hi. Can you hear me?
Sure can.
Yeah, great. I have two questions for the Russian expert. I don't know if he's still on,
yes, he is.
On the line.
Yes.
And the first question is, he mentioned that the Russian parliament still doesn't know what to do about Putin, but the two-thirds majority gives him another option. I just wonder, I haven't been following the Russian politics closely lately. What does he mean by that? The parliament doesn't know what to do about Putin, and why is that? Why are they still undecided whether they're going to make him
give him a third term, try to suspend the
correct
term limits. Yeah, Professor Cullen?
It's not the parliament that doesn't know what to do about Putin. It's Putin that doesn't know what to do about Putin. The parliament won't decide this. The Kremlin will decide. There have been several plans. One is to arrange for him to have a semi-constitutional third term, but they fear that would delegitimize Putin in Europe. They don't care about the United States anymore. They're convinced that no matter what they do, the United States is going to bash them. But they do care about Europe. The other idea was to make him prime minister, which would be entirely legal and reasonable, not president. But Russia has a very bad history of what is known in Russian history as dual power. Two power centers. Russians serve one master. You can't have two masters of politics. It's destabilizing. And the third idea was to create something called the national leader, as China's had in the past. It wouldn't occupy an office, but Putin would have all this authority that would transcend real politics. The problem there is Russia's not China, and it isn't going to work. Our various Kremlin aides to Putin have suggested these various approaches, but then second thoughts have ruled them out. That's why I say at the moment the Kremlin doesn't know what to do when Putin's legal term ends in March.
We're just about out of time. But, Stephen, you know, the term does end in March. And given how long our presidential campaign has been going on already for next November, why isn't Russia knee-deep in presidential politics?
Well, traditionally, they don't have our long campaigns. In fact, our long campaigns are a very bad idea. It puts a premium on money, and it wears everybody out, and it leaves too much time for non-consequential discourse. Very few nations have electoral campaigns as long as ours. The real danger here is that the American government and a lot of foundations and democracy promoters are going to become convinced that our experience is the only relevant one for Russia and seize this unpretty election in Russia that occurred on Sunday to try to intervene politically again in Russia. And I think that would be exceedingly dangerous and not good for our national security. But I think it's coming, and too many of the presidential candidates are actually advocating that course now.
We will have to leave it there. Stephen Cohen, Professor of History and Russian and Slavic Languages at NYU. John Walsh, Senior Associate for the Andes at the Washington Office on Latin America. Two fascinating elections with lots of implications over the weekend for the countries of Venezuela and Russia and the United States. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, a call-in on whether Don Imus deserves his second chance. We'll play a little bit of his apology to the Rutgers women's basketball team and take your calls.